Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote. On this episode of Talking Australia, I'm chatting to Tyson Juncker-Porter. In 2019, Tyson published Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, in which he examines global systems from an Indigenous perspective. Tyson tells us about how lines, symbols and shapes can help us make sense of the world, why we need to listen more carefully and look at accepted norms from a different perspective. So I'm really excited to be chatting to Tyson today on this episode of Talking Australia. Sand Talk was published in 2019 to immense critical acclaim. For those who haven't yet read the book, give us a bit of a rundown about, you know, what it's about.
Well, the title of the book, Sand Talk, it refers to an Indigenous way of creating, producing, transmitting, storing knowledge, but mostly passing knowledge on by creating images, usually temporary images and often drawn on the ground. You know, often even just with a stick or a finger in the sand, in that way, but, sometimes it uses other objects, and there are sort of just everyday forms of that, but then there's big, ritual forms as well that are sort of in more secret ceremonies. But the protocol is that you have to wipe it away, as soon as you're finished. So that's the idea of what Sand Talk is, but Sand Talk itself, the book, it's about, it kind of expands the idea of what a book can be. How would you write a book that was trying to go beyond the limits of what print can do? So it's kind of trying to turn it more into a conversation with the reader, you know, doing a series of thought experiments together and using various sort of little language devices and things like that. But it also uses the visual images, the Sand Talk images, which convey just as much information as, you know, printed on the pages. And also for every chapter is composed first through traditional activities, mostly in these cases carving. So the chapters are composed by carving traditional objects. And then basically each chapter is a translation of part of the knowledge that's in that traditional object. So it's a very interactive, kinesthetic, almost topographical, you know, it's very place-based. There are sort of inner maps that we go along together, you know, in a little kinship pair, myself and the reader. So, you know, so I use a pronoun that isn't present in English. It's in Aboriginal languages, and it's linguists call it the dual first person plural. And I've translated that into English as us two, hyphenated, which was nearly the title of the book. So, you know, as far as I know, it's the first book ever that's been written in the dual first person plural. So it's basically a lot of really interesting stuff like that that changes what a book can be and therefore is able to explore a lot of very, very interesting, very deep knowledge, you know, in a collaborative way. So it sort of brings the stories, these Aboriginal stories alongside the stories of the reader, you know, so it's dialogical in that way. There's just as much information that the reader is bringing to the process as the writer is bringing.
And obviously it talks a lot about, you know, how Indigenous thinking can save the world. And, you know, give me a little bit of background about you and how you came to writing a book like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problems that we're facing in the world over this last particularly half century that we've been living in, they're very, very complex problems. So you need very complex ways of thinking to look at them and to deal with them. And so I guess that's what this book is offering, is the kind of thinking that's needed to come up with sustainability problems, to come up even with a definition of sustainability that's real. I found myself very frustrated with the way that word's been used. And I think the turning point for me was being, you know, the Indigenous representative at a big meeting, which with the topic of the meeting was, how can we sustainably double this city's population in the next 10 years?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was just like, yeah, you got a bad definition of sustainable
just
there,
a
buddy.
Little bit.
Yeah. So that was a bit of a turning point for me. But the book itself, I mean, I don't know. I've been doing this work just mostly in conversations with people and, you know, talking to large groups of people, small groups of people for over a decade now. And I hadn't even thought of writing a book, but I was approached by the publisher and asked to write one. And they said, oh, we'll give you a cash advance. And I said, yeah, I need that cash. So, yeah, that's how the book came about.
Mm. And one of the biggest takeaways from the book for me was, you know, all the different ways Indigenous knowledge can be applied to the education and financial systems rather than what you call isolated examples of sustainability.
Yeah.
And you also say that you want to sort of reverse that phenomenon that you were actually just speaking about. How do you do that?
How do you do that? well, that's just it. It's a... With most other fields of knowledge, people don't have a problem with the idea of transferability. But for some reason with Indigenous knowledge, you know, people find it impossible to look at the processes, the reasoning, the logics, the structures, you know, the paradigms, things like that, that can be transferable across to pretty much any other context. For some reason, those things are invisible, you know, to most people, Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people. And I think it's because we've all come to position anything Indigenous as this kind of artifact frozen in time, as this bit of primitive exotica. So, you know, the idea of... you know, looking at in like it, you know, you would look therefore at a band of people moving across the landscape, and you'd be looking at, oh, what are they hunting? What are they eating? How are they cooking it? What you're not look for some reason, nobody's looking at what their governance models are. That's obviously a group that has found a way to exist together, you know, using some quite exciting. You know, leadership and governance models that are, you know, like a kind of super democracy or something. And those sorts of patterns are very transferable, very useful, and are probably of more use to sustainability systems than, you know, so what can Goanafat be used for? You know, that there's, you know, that kind of declarative Indigenous knowledge, like, you know, where can I find a tree sap that will cure a headache? You know, that's important too. But we know that that's present and people are looking at that. What people aren't looking at are the frameworks, the models, the theories, and the methodologies. So, you know, what does an Indigenous method of inquiry look like? And what can that bring to your scientific method? To make it more effective. You know, and I've done this quite a bit with in a few different contexts, you know, where, you know, people are performing the same experiment. They have a hypothesis, but every time they do it, they get different results. And so it's not replicable. It's not generalizable. And they have to just go inconclusive. But then, you know, I can come in and apply a few variables that are a focus of Indigenous inquiry and completely change the outcomes of their experiments. Because it turns out there were a couple of key things they were missing. So to me, this is the really important and really urgent kind of Indigenous knowledge that we need to be working with and embracing in order to solve the wicked problems that are facing us in the world.
Mm. And just for those who haven't read the book, what are some of those big problems that you analyze and, you know, the way that you apply Indigenous knowledge to solving those? Like I mentioned, my favorite parts were, you know, the education and financial systems.
Oh, yeah. So the, yes, the education systems. Applying our, you know, our pedagogies and knowledge transmission methods to the education system. Unfortunately, Indigenous pedagogies will only lead you to a place where you have to completely reimagine from top to bottom what the education system looks like, which strangely enough has been a weird idea that hasn't gained much traction until the last few months when almost everything is on the table now, you know, from universal basic incomes to debt jubilees. You know, there's insane ideas, you know, even in the financial system like that.
Yeah, COVID's really brought out a lot of these conversations.
Yeah, people wouldn't countenance the ideas before. They were crazy ideas, but now they seem very, very sane. Same with the education. So with the education system, as soon as everyone was on lockdown and, you know, they realized we've been sitting on this technology for, you know, decades now that would allow students to access learning from anywhere on the planet at any time of day, and, you know, that they'd be able to be completely, you know, independent learners, free-ranging through a universe of knowledge with, you know, any kind of mentor in any imaginable discipline from anywhere in the world. We've been sitting on that tech for ages and it has not changed one iota of what the education system can be. And then all of a sudden all the kids are on lockdown and, you know, in the first couple of weeks everyone realized that they were completing all of their schoolwork for the day in about an hour and then just playing. So they had to go, oh, that's no good. We're going to have to sit them in front of the screen and keep our eyeballs on them and make sure we can see their eyeballs, which is incidentally historically where the word pupil came from. For students, it was the idea of a teacher standing at the front of a massive room full of rows of desks and dominating the room with the pupils. That's how. So the idea was, if you could see the pupils of the students' eyes, then you were able to control them and dominate them with your stare. And then if that didn't work, then you hit them with a stick. And nothing's changed. So we've got technology is coming out now out of the UK and out of the US, out of the big universities there, and getting lots and lots, like billions in funding, particularly from people who are interested in data mining. So they've got neural nets now that they can put on students where you can read the student's brain activity in real time. Only the teacher can see that, though, because it's projected as a hologram above the student's head that only the teacher can see because they're wearing special glasses. That's one of the technologies that's coming out. And the idea is that all the students' brain activity will be uploaded to servers in real time because that's really essential data. So students, these pupils, their, you know, their function will be to provide data for AI to graze on into the future. But what's amazing with all these, this amazing new AI tech that they're bringing in to revolutionize education, every photo I see of the test subjects, the test classrooms, the classrooms still look the same. The students are sitting at their desks in rows with a teacher at the front, and the students are doing worksheets. The tech is not there to expand for the students what they can learn and what can be known. You know, knowledge is not being given to the students, it's being extracted from them. And it's just a continuation of what education's always done. So in the same way that now we force the kids to still sit for 7 hours in front of the screen and look at their teacher via a Zoom, so that the teacher can slow down the pace at which they do their work and stretch an hour's worth of work out to a full day. Yeah, because basically in the end, you know, the purpose of education is to prepare students to become docile workers for a workplace. And that is, it's openly stated as the main exit goal for education. So that's what we've got. And that's all it's going to be, no matter what the tech does. It's always going to be these poor students sitting in rows and learning how to do busy work so that they can sell their time to people, you know, a full day of it.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. What I really appreciate about the book so much is that you do give so much context to these systems that, to be honest, like I hadn't really given a lot of thought about. You know, a lot of the book talks about how society struggles to look back and connect the dots and where we come from and, you know, how we have the systems that we have now. Can you tell me about that line of thinking about the need for context and, you know, how maybe our lack of maybe the fact that we don't look back as much is impacting society and, you know, how that manifests itself in today's issues?
Well, I think... every society does this, but you know, this society is looking back. It is constantly looking back, sort of creating these fantastical stories about the past or selectively piecing together these histories. But that's something that civilization does. It controls the present by controlling what people know of the past. So, you know, most of the systems we have in place, from law and order to finance to education to medicine to science to everything else, is all grounded in this sort of myth of progress and this myth of primitivism and this story about a primitive past, which can be changed at a moment's notice as needed. But basically the story is that, you know, we've been monkeys that have been wandering around for 500,000 years, going, you know, ooga booga and just, you know, endlessly raping and murdering each other until finally, you know, civilization came along and saved us from ourselves. You know, and that we've had this history of just stupidity and just walking around in absolute fear because we never know when the tigers are going to jump out at us in nature. It's just all of it's such a lie. Like, you spend time with any indigenous culture anywhere and you'll find that nobody's worried about the tigers because you're so embedded in the landscape that you know where the tigers are. You always know where the tigers are. There are indicators. There's a lot of complex thinking and very complex culture, far more complex than what we're living in today. And that's how we managed to grow this massive brain that we have with the potential for trillions of neural connections. But I guess, you know, that story of our primitive, brutish, Paleolithic past is, I mean, it's always changed as facts need to change. So, for example, I mean, we were always told the story until very recently, the last few years, that Neanderthals had this tiny brain and were basically just like monkeys. And, you know, that they were sort of hairy and dull and didn't live for very long. And that story persisted right up until they made that discovery just a few years ago that that all Europeans have Neanderthal DNA. You know, up to 5%, I think they were saying, Neanderthal DNA. And then like within weeks, all these new stories got, like they actually just went into the cupboards and pulled out all the stuff that didn't fit the story and just went, look, look, the skulls are bigger. The brains are actually bigger than bigger than any other species ever. Look at that, you know. The Neanderthal brain was huge, and look, they actually lived for quite a long. And we're finding that, yeah, Neanderthals actually lived quite a sophisticated lifestyle. You know, so those parts of the stories changed. But other parts didn't. It's very selective. So, for example, the things that reinforce gender roles, and particularly the position of women in the society, they were kind of glossed over. So the fact that Paleolithic women, specifically Neanderthal women, had the same fracture patterns in their bones as the males did, that would indicate that women were hunting too. because it's firmly established that those fracture patterns, which are similar to the fracture patterns of rodeo clowns, were from hunting megafauna in a particular place. And the women had the same fracture patterns, but those findings didn't come out. Oh my goodness, this idea of men were the hunters and women were the gatherers is actually not true. Women were hunting just as much as men. And also they kind of glossed over the age of a lot of the, so they were finding, you know, people in extreme old age, even people who'd been born disabled and would have had to have been carried about and looked after, were living to a very old age. So that would mean that there was a kind of abundance there, and there was a very advanced culture where people were caring for each other, but also that people were so healthy that they were living for very long periods. And you put that alongside the bone fracture patterns. It obviously wasn't only the fittest survive. If you break your leg, you're left behind and you die kind of thing. I mean, obviously, people had quite advanced and superior medicine, so they were able to heal quickly. They had very good diets and kind of advanced care systems and things like this. You know, all these things are looked over. But you see that a lot of the same things, that there's always an evolutionary explanation to any scientific theory, not just scientific theory, but anything like law and order. You know, people go, well, you know, we have to have these, you know, these policing structures in place, because without it, people will descend into anarchy and no woman will be safe. Everybody will be just raping everybody and murdering everybody because that's what humans do. You know, it'll be just like, you know, and that's just an evolutionary thing. That's just the fittest survive thing that's coming out of our caveman ancestry. And it's like, well, actually, no, that's not what we're like naturally. So that doesn't really justify those measures you're taking. It is worth actually looking at, you know, what we call indigenous now, but is just human. It is worth looking at what those patterns of logic and those ways of thinking and those ways of structuring a society have been for most of human history, and have worked really well for most of human history and allowed us to thrive through massive cycles of climate change and meteor strikes and volcanic eruptions and everything else. You know, we've been an incredibly adaptive, incredibly just amazing cultures of genius all over this planet that we've had for most of human history. And now we're this industrialized, domesticated thing that really just doesn't have the capacity to organize or think or sustain anything. It is worth revisiting. And it doesn't mean returning to, oh, we've all got to be bloody hunting mammoths on the tundra. That's not what I'm talking about. You know, I'm talking about taking those patterns of logic and those social patterns and those ways of being, living a life that is embedded in the landscape and is responsive to the habitats we live in. Those things can be transferred and applied.
Particularly with regard to Indigenous Australia and the need for context. I mean, what's the best way to give context and allow people to understand, you know, histories that are true I mean, how do we give people context? What's the best way, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's it's going to involve like shifting things around, particularly intent. I mean, so what's the intent of sharing knowledge about Indigenous people that makes us look good? What's the reason for that? You know, and the reasoning behind it is, it seems nice. It's these social justice sort of principles. It's this idea that, you know, if we can show people how lovely Indigenous culture is, that there will be enough respect that suddenly, you know, this colony, this civilization here will suddenly just become more fair, will treat us better, will treat everybody equally, and, you know, will reform. You know, we'll basically just redistribute things around a little bit, but then continue as normal, but everybody's equal. I think that's the intent behind the sharing of a lot of this knowledge, behind the truth telling of history and things like this. So of course there's going to be a struggle back and forth, because the people who are in the civilization and benefiting from it, you know, within the dominant culture, you know, this represents an existential risk. This is not an economic system, and any economist will tell you this, it's not an economic system that can continue and that can thrive if equality actually becomes a real thing. This is an economic system that depends on inequality, and it basically comes down to the economic problem. It's in the first chapter of every economics textbook 101. You know, and the economic problem is that in a growth-based economy, demand must exceed supply. So there needs to be more people needing things than there are things. So you have to limit the supply in order for anything, and deny, you know, half the population equitable access to that supply in order for anything to have value and in order for there to be economic growth. So the idea that you can just turn around and just suddenly go, oh, but they're really nice people, and oh, we can respect them, and then everything will be equal. it's a ridiculous idea. And so it's an existential risk to the civilization to acknowledge Aboriginal culture and history, or indeed the cultures and histories of anybody that's not an embedded part of the Anglosphere, ethnically Anglo.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. I want to go back to something you said about growth-based economic systems. I've heard you speak a lot about growth-based systems versus an increased system, which is more based on Indigenous knowledge and the way of seeing the world. So, would you be able to like map out those differences?
Yeah. So, I think we've got a pretty good handle on what a growth-based economic system is. You know, if growth slows, you find yourself in a recession. If growth stops, you know, or reverses even, you have yourself in a depression, such as the 10-year depression we're coming into right now. that's in a growth-based economic system. And that's that paradigm. But the Indigenous economic system, and indeed just ontological, you know, existential system, is an increased paradigm. And that sounds like the same thing, growth and increase, but it's actually very different. In an increased paradigm, you're not trying to increase the size of the system. You're trying to increase the connections within it. So it's the same. If you want to become smarter, you do not need to get a bigger brain. You just need to increase the neural connections and activity that's happening in your brain, or make them more efficient, you know. So you've got the potential for trillions of neural connections in your brain right now, and you're only really using 5 to 15% of those. And it's the same with an economic system. You know, so what would be of more interest to us from an Aboriginal point of view, we wouldn't be interested in quantitative easing as a response to an economic crisis. We'd probably be more interested in a thought experiment about, well, what would qualitative easing look like? So, for example, how could we increase the velocity of the dollar? Rather than printing more of the amount of dollars that are out there, we'd be thinking like, how could we make sure that each dollar is changing hands and being exchanged 10 times as many times as is going on right now? You know, so you you give a dollar to a cab driver who then buys a cup of coffee with it, and then in the cafe that's then paid as cash wages to a casual employee who then goes out and buys themselves a pizza with that, and then the pizza shop owner uses that dollar for something. And so the dollar, you know, goes through, you know, thousands of different exchanges first before it ends up, you know, being redirected into a static heap, as taxation or savings or, you know, worse, ended up being sucked into the financial system, the global financial system of money on money return, you know, disappearing into, you know, this financial class, basically just, creating value out of nothing, which ends up just being a pyramid scheme where, you know, all the dollars of the people at the bottom of the pyramid, of course, end up disappearing like smoke. So that's the kind of, you know, application of that logic. See, are you getting that? Yeah. I hope I'm getting across the idea that, you know, this knowledge is transferable.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not just, you know, how to cook a possum.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's, how to fix a global financial crisis.
Which actually goes perfectly into my next question. I know following the bushfires, there was a kind of an increased interest in applying Indigenous knowledge to the fight against climate change. I'm wondering, going back to what you said before about, tokenistic approaches to applying Indigenous knowledge and the need for white people to kind of be willing to give up certain things, I'm wondering how we might apply Indigenous knowledge to the climate change crisis in a meaningful way?
I guess for a start, if you were really applying Indigenous logic to it, you would get rid of this false separation of the idea of climate and weather. I know that sounds like a really out of the box and off topic idea, but you know, climate and weather are regarded as two different things. You know, so, you know, weather is something that just happens and we move with it. when I say we, I mean, you know, human beings living in this society. But then climate in this current, societal paradigm, this global scientific paradigm, climate is something that can be reduced to a number of units. It can be measured. It can be scaled. It can be predictable. And it can be tinkered with. You know, so there's this idea that we can tinker with the climate and change the outcomes. As you can see, there's a reason that econometrics models were used as the basis, and all that software was used as the basis for a lot of climate modeling, because it's the same. It's based on the same illusion. That idea that you can, you know, reduce something to a number of parts, tinker with it, and you know, produce the desired outcomes that you want. We could probably stop looking at it like that. And yes, we need to recognize that the pollution that we're creating is having an effect on the climate. and it's going to have, you know, long-term effects on the climate, there's yes, but the pollution is having a lot of other effects on a lot of other things too, and you don't want to take your eye off that ball, you know. And we need to be looking at ways of creating cultures, economies, and systems of transition that are able to transition with massive changes in the landscape, you know, and in the climate, because it's not just the climate. You know, these coastlines are going to change dramatically and sooner than people think, because all they're doing with the climate models is projecting how much sea levels are going to rise. What they're not looking at is sand mining, which, oh no, sorry, that's an unrelated, that's in someone else's discipline. That's in a silo over there. We're not looking at sand and mining here. We're looking at climate. Whoa, back it up. That's the biggest resource on the planet right now that's being used because of the sustainable doubling of all these infrastructure projects that are rolling out like crazy everywhere as part of the quantitative easing of things to try and keep the construction industry going, to try and keep the economy going, and to try and keep doubling this population so that we can maintain somebody else's economic system. Ah, it's insane. So the sand is being all used up, and terrestrial sources of sand are gone. So they're having to dredge it out of the ocean now along the coastline. So you end up with these massive holes in the seabed, and they don't just stay there like that. You know, they get filled with sand that should be going elsewhere along the coast, and so that sand isn't deposited on beaches. Or you get massive slumps, you know, where the entire seabed slumps into that hole, and what happens is the coastline erodes and falls into it. So we're going to find that the coastline sinks faster than the sea level rises. You know, these are related issues. If we're looking at, okay, well, how, since we've got most of the population clustered around the coastline, because the culture is so terrified of this continent, and so terrified of a landscape that they don't understand, that they're huddled along the beach. You know, there's a lot that needs to change. There's a lot of thinking that needs doing, and a lot of action too, a lot of practical action, particularly of just understanding the landscape and becoming part of the landscape again. Yes, it's important to return land to Aboriginal people, but equally as important is that we need to return all humans to the land. People need to once again become, you know, a being, a species that has a habitat and that is embedded in that habitat and is responsive to changes in that habitat, because that habitat's going to be changing frequently and rapidly as this global meta crisis continues to unfold, a crisis of climate / weather, a crisis of toxicity and massive species extinction and elimination of a biosphere in response to 1,000 different things, economic crises, social crises, all kinds of upheavals. And we're going to have to tap back into our natural gift of our species as the custodial species, which is adaptation.
I want to talk a little bit about, going back to talking about engagement, I want to talk about this process of respect, connect, reflect, direct, that you talk about in the book. In the book, you talk about how when engaging with Indigenous people, white people will often do that process in reverse. Do you think that's at the heart of getting engagement right, this process of respect, connect, reflect, direct?
I've just got to get onto the language there, you know, of white people. You know, I'm not talking about white people like people with fair skin. You know, like a lot of settlers and an increasingly number of settlers who are, you know, ethnically Anglo, the sort of the settler civilizing, you know, command and control sort of discourses that are running our lives. You know, many, if not most of them, do not have white skin. So this is what multiculturalism is. It's everybody being Anglo, no matter what color you are. So when we refer to white people, I guess if you want to use that term, it's not talking about people with pale skin, which is probably half the Aboriginal population at the moment. Would be people with pale skin. So, yeah, that doesn't really work as a terminology anymore. So, yeah, getting that straight again. What's the question? White people are doing what?
Reversing the process.
They're reversing that process of respect, connect, reflect, direct. Instead, they come in and they direct, and then it fails. So they reflect and they gather their data and examine their metrics, and then they realize that they probably should have formed relationships, and so then they connect. And then, so they make, through those connections, they end up finally arriving at respect just as the program winds up and they fly out. That seems to have been an observation that that a lot of people are, finding it is striking a chord of truth with what they're seeing when they look out at the world. A reversal of that process, you know, starting with respect is probably the best way to go.
And how would you like people to use Sand Talk?
Any way they like. The idea is that it's just a yarn, and it's different for everybody. I've not spoken to two different people who had the same experience of reading it. So yeah, I think it's just a dialogic process of engagement, and a lot of people come out of that with really out of the box disruptive innovations. And I'm just seeing hundreds and hundreds of these things. People who've started up different kind of action groups, different kinds of not-for-profit organizations, or they've just changed their organization's structure, you know, not based on the ideas in the book, like they're copying it, but based on the thinking that they've done as a result of engaging in that dialogue, which is, I think, is really important distinction. You know, if anybody's just taking ideas out of my book and just applying them as they are, then they're probably not really engaging with it properly. Most people are just coming up with exciting things. I had a climate scientist contact me and say she's been sitting on a bunch of data for years and she couldn't figure out how to do the analysis of it properly, but then beyond that, even couldn't figure out how, even if she did manage to analyze it, how she could present that in a way that people would understand. And she just, she found after she read my book that she just woke up in the middle of the night one night and went, oh, there it is, that's the solution. And she found the solution and was able to use that data. There's been a lot of people from a lot of different fields, you know, from economics to social work to childcare to almost anything, who've, found themselves stimulated to create these amazing innovations just out of nowhere. And not by going by the book, but sort of with the book, I guess.
Well, I'm a big fan of the book, and thank you so much for chatting with me today, Tyson.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingAustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingAustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.